You know ID in the D in the L all day. ID in the D in the S E A. You know ID in the D in the L all day. ID in the D in the S E A.
Hello and welcome to episode number 79 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you live from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks. And now home to Dwayne Brown.
Oh,
what a day.
Home to Dwayne Brown. I was listening through to our Seahawks recap episode, which if you haven't listened to that yet, first off, we apologize for the fuzz that is present throughout the episode. We're aware that it's happening.
Yeah, if you're a new listener, it's not always like that.
Just like 60 to 70% of the time.
And we're hopeful we have a fix going forward. Don't have that fixed tonight. So fingers crossed.
But imagine if we could have just talked about Dwayne Brown at the end of that. I might have jumped out a window.
You were already pretty fired up as it was before knowing.
If I would have been doing my ode to football at the very end and then the Seahawks would have traded for Dwayne Brown, there's no telling what I would have done.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Well, we've got a lot to get to today, but first, I think we should start by wishing everyone out there, if you're listening to this on the day it comes out, a happy Halloween. And to you, may be the first to wish you a happy Halloween, even though it's still an hour out. I think we'll get there by the end of this episode.
Yeah, save it for later.
So we have a Halloween-themed beer, once again, and that beer is the Elysian The Great Pumpkin, one of the several dozen Elysian pumpkin varieties. That's not a joke. I think that's...
They've scaled it back pretty significantly. There was one year, I think this might have been the year before they were purchased by Anheuser-Busch.
And before Anheuser-Busch ran the ad during the Super Bowl talking about, we don't make pumpkin beers.
Yeah,
what a great time that was.
Do you want me to read about this one?
Sure.
This is the Great Pumpkin Imperial Pumpkin Ale. I believe named after the Charlie Brown and the Great Pumpkin. Not very classic Charlie Brown.
I've never had an Imperial Pumpkin Ale, though, so tell me more about what that entails.
The Great Pumpkin is the world's first Imperial Pumpkin Ale, if you'd had another one.
Of course I have.
It would be an imposter. It's packed with pumpkin and roasted pumpkin seeds and spiced with cinnamon, nutmeg, cloves, cardamom, and I added the cardamom on my own, and allspice. Pour carefully, my friend. Great Pumpkin is unfiltered and may contain sediment.
Okay.
That's just a warning.
Look, I understand people of the internet that cardamom is a popular spice, especially in Southeast Asian cooking. It still sounds to me like a version of Octomom with a different number of children. That's what it sounds like.
Did I tell you that I felt like it was the most Seattle thing ever, that when I think of cardamom, I think about ice cream?
And that definitely is the most Seattle thing ever.
I remember there was a TVA where you were talking about ice cream flavors, and they're like, nothing fancy. And I'm like, well, cardamom ice cream, obviously. They're like, give me vanilla and strawberry. I'm like, nah, inedible.
Yep.
If it doesn't have goat cheese in it, I'm not eating it. Right, but as I pour this, we didn't get to... We really luckily didn't get to.
Yeah, quite thankfully.
Have a contest this week on the Pelton Cast. You promised Shea Serrano on last week's special edition with Shea Serrano that if the Texans were to have won, you would go out and purchase as many copies of his brilliant book, Basketball and Other Things, as the margin of victory for the Texans. Fortunately for the Seahawks, that didn't happen. Unfortunately for Shea Serrano, we're buying no books. You should still go buy it on your own.
Yes.
But we felt like... It would still be nice to have a contest involved with this week's Pelton Cast.
So instead, as a prize, and by the way, we should have made this more like one of the like governor bets where they bet things from their state and forced Shea to buy copies of Pro Basketball Prospectus 2012-13.
Yeah, wherever he could find them. He'd have to contact us to get those copies.
On Amazon. Okay. You can still order those.
So
I don't think I'm getting residuals on those.
The lucky winners on to get those.
Anyways, instead, sadly, we will not be giving out copies of Pro Basketball Prospectus 2012-13. Instead, we are going to give out the hottest merch that you cannot possibly buy. That's a Pelton Cast hat, of course. You've seen
right
them on
here.
Twitter a handful of times.
As seen on Twitter, as seen on my head most of the time.
Sometimes on both of our heads at the same time. It's a little awkward when we both walk around wearing our Pelton Cast hats.
Anytime that there's a group of two people together wearing bright red hats, it's bad. But especially when it's you and me, it is not a good look. Also, you're not a comfortable hat wearer.
I am certainly not that. I am anything but that.
But so what should we do as a contest for these hats? I got to get the pouring.
So the idea you had was celebrating Dwayne Brown's arrival.
Sorry, Shay.
Yeah. Also, we will not be having him back on because he said he would only come back on to talk trash had the Texans won that game. We're going to hope that the Seahawks run for more than 5 rushing yards from their running backs this Sunday in a game we will preview down the road about against the Washington Professional Football Team. So we want you to guess how many yards the Seahawks running backs have on the ground this weekend combined.
So we're not including Tyler Lockett here. I'm not including Tyler Lockett. Just running backs.
So either tweet that to us.
Fullbacks? Do fullbacks count?
Yes, Trey Madden counts.
Okay.
Either tweet this to us using the hashtag PeltonCastHat or email us at PeltonCast@gmail.com with your guess. And we're not going to do it Price is Right style. Closest to the pin. So maybe if you want to go in the negatives, you know, just stake that out for yourself. Whoever is closest wins a PeltonCast hat.
Wow. Something you literally cannot buy.
It's true.
Because of copyright infringement.
Yep.
You gotta draw the line somewhere. Will not ever be able to buy. I mean, I have to say this PeltonCast hat has pulled together my entire wardrobe. So good luck to everybody. What if multiple people win?
Then we'll give out multiple hats. We've got enough to do that.
Wow.
I mean, it seems unlikely that two people are going to guess like 23 yards. I don't know. Maybe if multiple people guess 25 in this question.
I'll be surprised if more than one person guesses at all.
that's true. We'll be pleasantly surprised. The listener will have to submit multiple guesses.
The listener just put in a number.
I don't know what we're toasting to.
We're toasting to a lot of things, to be honest.
To Dwayne Brown.
To Dwayne Brown, to Halloween.
Yeah.
But also we're pouring one out. I know we're going to talk about this later.
Absolutely. This is a sad day. With the passing of Husky legend Daniel Teo-Nesheim at the age of 30, which is just impossibly young.
Do we know anything else about this?
I haven't seen any further details on cause of death. So
shocking news, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, really, really tragic. So hard to move on from that one to talk about frivolity.
I thought we were going to do a natural moment of silence there. So in the spirit of Halloween, we promised this on the Texans Seahawks recap that we did yesterday. We're going to be ranking Halloween candies.
Did we promise or threaten it?
It was the thing that most people responded to.
it really truly was.
The things that people responded to the most were whether it was the running backs who were the issue, which we're going to find out pretty soon, maybe.
Hopefully.
And also to my bad takes about Kit Kats, which, come on, they're bad.
Oh.
No. Oh,
okay,
wow.
So you did your top 5 worst Halloween candies. I did my top 5 best Halloween candies.
Wow, when I go low, you go high.
Which do you want to start with?
Let's do the top 5 best first.
All right.
I'm curious if there are any candies. I'm guessing that there's at least one.
Well,
that's going to appear on both of these
lists. You can guess. So, despite my vow that I purchased Kit Kats because I didn't think they were good enough that I would crack into them ahead of Halloween, obviously I did.
You had all these people tweeting at you about how good Kit Kats were. You're like, I need to eat one.
And Kit Kats are great, as it turns out. So they are my number 5. I wanted to know here, did you happen to catch on 538.com their ultimate Halloween candy power ranking?
Really? No.
They crowdsourced voters in actually much the same way as the NBA rank determinations are done on ESPN.
We're going to pause this entire podcast so I can go look this up.
Kit Kat comes in number 4 in their rankings. Kit Kat is enormously popular.
Well, 538 does a lot of ultimate things.
Your take is hashtag bad. I don't know why you didn't go. It's on the front page. Just go to 538.com. Scroll down below the coverage of indictments.
That's what we're secretly toasting to that also.
You'll find it.
Okay, fine. You know my feelings about Kit Kats. You'll hear more about it later.
All right, number 4. Reese's Peanut Butter Cup.
Number 4?
I don't think it's quite as good as the best of bars, but it's a very strong. The Reese's, in general, highly represented on the 538 list. The Peanut Butter Cup comes in number 1.
Reese's Miniature is number 1. First off, what is a Reese's Miniature? Just the miniature peanut butter cups? That should not be a separate candy, personally.
Yeah.
It's an extension of the Reese's Peanut Butter Cup.
Here's my thing about the Reese's Miniatures versus the Peanut Butter Cup. The ratio of peanut butter to chocolate is much higher on the Peanut Butter Cup than on the miniature. And yes. I prefer the peanut butter.
Oh, yeah. Peanut butter is great.
Yeah.
So pound for pound, the best to ever come around, right? Excluding nobody. Reese's Peanut Butter Cup is the number 1 candy in the entire world.
Interesting.
And the specific type of Reese's Peanut Butter Cup, there are a couple of them. So I've eaten a lot of these in the last year. I've eaten hundreds.
They're making up for lost time.
There are people who know me who can attest that sometimes I will get an entire bag of Reese's peanut butter cups and eat them in one day. It's not healthy. I do not do that quite as much lately. But the best Reese's peanut butter cup is the big cup, because you're getting twice as much peanut butter and the same amount of chocolate. Because chocolate's fine, but the peanut butter is the real winner there.
It's the star of the show.
Or seasonally, they'll have Reese's pumpkins, right? Which it's a larger circumference for there to be peanut butter and a smaller amount of chocolate. So pumpkins, Easter eggs, things like that.
Yeah, the Easter eggs are good. I've never had the pumpkin variety.
Right, I almost got a bag of them today.
In number three, M&M's with peanuts.
Peanuts instead of peanut butter.
Yeah, I slightly prefer peanuts to peanut butter, and regular M&Ms are inedible. I mean, I say that obviously. If there was a bowl of M&Ms here, I would eat it.
Of course, you would eat it.
So one of the things I was thinking about as I constructed this list is I actually faced this choice at Blazers games.
Really?
They in the media section have a couple of baskets of candy bars, and so I have my choice of what to get, and M&M's with peanuts are my number two choice. I guess they are my number three. The number two on my list, not as readily available.
Do they have peanut butter M&M's at these Blazers games, or just
I
peanut?
I don't think so. I think just peanut M&Ms. All right, in number two.
We need to talk about M&M's really quick.
The varieties of M&M's.
So again, this is a conversation. I talk about candy a lot.
With your coworkers?
Yeah, at my work, basically every single day at 4 o'clock, we'll walk to Bartell Drugs and go get some candy. My body is desperate for candy at 4 o'clock every single day.
Is it like when Elaine had the sugar high need in the afternoon, and then she opted out of the birthday cake celebration, so she had to eat the ancient cake in Peterman's office?
Basically, I've eaten a lot of ancient cakes. Man, I should reconsider Dots for my top five worst candies. Anyway. So we've had a lot of conversations about this, and my coworker Josh explained it to me like this. I'm new to peanut butter candies, right?
That is true.
He's like, peanut M&Ms came first, and they are so much better than M&Ms. But then peanut butter M&Ms came around, and so I don't think positively, because I've lived in a world where we had both.
You've only known a world
where he lived in a world where you only had regular M&Ms versus peanut M&Ms, and the difference is huge, right? So I'm taking for granted peanut M&Ms.
Can I make the case for peanut M&Ms vis-a-vis peanut butter M&Ms?
Absolutely.
The crunch. It's much more satisfying.
Okay.
Oh, you got to have the crunch, which we'll get to in a second here.
Ooh. Oh, God. Is a crunch bar on your list?
No.
Okay. You're not a monster.
Jeez. In number two, I was stunned how low this came out in 538's rankings. Snickers.
Yeah.
Always satisfies.
Well, number five. I mean, it's not like...
But I was still surprised that it was... I mean, five is much lower than number two.
It's not like Jokic in your NBA rankings.
Because I would say it's 1B. Snickers for a long period of time was probably my number one, but right now it is not my go-to. And that go-to is Twix.
Oh, Twix are great.
Twix are great. They came in number three on the 538 list.
For a child who grew up not being able to eat peanuts, Twix were like the candy. I mean, it's Twix and Milky Way to me, right there.
I'm not big on Milky Way. Doesn't do it for me.
I'm fine with that. I was going to get angry at you, but I'm actually fine with that.
Okay. I don't want too much nougat unless there's the peanuts there to complement it. I mean, this is, by the way, the food allergies. It's a problem with the top of this list because you've got Reese's.
Couldn't have
Snickers
them. Couldn't have fifth. Them. Couldn't have them.
Reese's.
Yes.
Four of the top six.
Reese's stuffed with pieces. They have to get that out of there. That should not be a separate candy.
That's a new thing.
I know it's a new thing, but it shouldn't be a separate candy. I'm sorry. And like, then, you can't go through all the different variations of Reese's. Reese's is the best. It's Muhammad Ali, right? It's the goat candy.
Six of the top 10 involved peanuts somehow.
It's the Celtics in the 60s.
And I would say, by the way, the one...
Right, was that the year they won all 10 championships?
They may have won some of them in the 50s, but close enough. Actually, maybe I guess not in the 50s, but one in the 70s. I only had one honorable mention that I considered here seriously, and that is Payday.
Oh, Payday is I've had like my first Payday recently. There are a lot of peanuts on there.
There are a lot of peanuts. I think that's a favorite of our moms. So I would maybe steal one or two from the fun size bag. All right. So controversially not on my list.
Oh.
Skittles.
Okay.
Starburst.
Okay.
Nowhere to be found. Really mostly only only bars with the exception of the M&Ms.
Okay, if I was ranking my top five, some ones that you didn't get to, Airheads.
Yeah.
When we were kids and we'd get a bag of Airheads, it was a celebration.
I feel like you always liked them more than I did.
Sour Patch Kids?
Not a fan.
Wow! Not a fan!
Don't like sour.
Oh, man. They're not sour. They're sweet. They're very, very mildly sour.
Not a fan.
That's pretty much it. I think I don't like candy that much. Swedish Fish? Wow! Man, on Swedish Fish?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, let's get to the bottom five.
All right, so your number five in the top five is the same as the bottom, the number five right. in my bottom five. What even are Kit Kats? It's a wafer? It's basically like a British candy.
But then you got chocolate.
I've
it's
had
satisfying
chocolate.
To snap them in half. It's a good experience.
These are all candies that if faced with these candies versus no candy at all, I'm choosing no candy at all.
Wow.
And Kit Kat falls into that list. I'm sorry, Kit Kat is bad, people. Kit Kat is bad candy.
Hashtag good.
It is not as bad as our number four worst candy, which is the Three Musketeers.
Interesting.
It's all nougat.
Yeah, no, I agree. I don't disagree with you.
Nougat is the worst thing. That's why they pair it with caramel and peanuts. That's why they pair it with caramel.
Right. Why do you consider it that much worse than Milky Way? Because of the caramel?
It pulls the whole thing together.
Okay. Three Musketeers,
also,
by
is the only. It's basically the only candy I had for like 18 years.
Three Musketeers,
actually, not even 18. For 30 years, I was eating Milky Ways.
But Three Musketeers was one you just said, right?
Yes.
Number 12 on the list, Milky Way number 7.
At number 3, Tootsie Rolls.
Yeah, that's fair. Tootsie Rolls is like, they were great before you had any other alternatives. They're like the original plain M&Ms of candies.
Yes, I feel like Tootsie Rolls must have been huge in like 1915. Right? Yeah. Our grandparents must have fucking loved Tootsie Rolls. It was amazing. It was candy.
Exactly. Right?
As far as I understood, they were picking gum off the ground and chewing it, maybe even tar off the ground. So Tootsie Rolls, a huge difference.
Tootsie Roll snack is number 40 on the list. Tootsie Roll Juniors, I'm not exactly sure. I assume that's just the smaller version, 54.
If they would have done the same list at the beginning of World War I, called the Great War at the time, they would have been number one easily. At number 2, Whoppers.
Yeah, not a fan.
Any person who likes Whoppers is a monster.
You heard that here first. If you like Whoppers, you are a monster.
I don't like malt, right? I've never basically eaten a malt in my entire life. And the gross crunch of a milk ball, oh, it's terrible. Oh, God, they make me sick even thinking about them.
Whoppers number 41 on the list. All right, the worst.
I went with a 1A and a 1B.
Okay.
So one of them I actually felt like was too low-hanging fruit. And I now looking at, I had not seen this list before right now, but my 1A is dead last on the list.
Good and Plenty?
Good and Plenty. I mean, those are, you could not find a single person who likes Good and Plenty if you're trying.
So wait, Good and Plenty are like the...
They're like the licorice flavored, like small jelly bean things.
But which are the ones that are like fruit flavored?
Those are Mike and Ike's.
Okay, and those are good.
Yeah, Mike and Ike's are solid.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know if I can remember the last time I've had Good and Plenty's. Mike and Ike's, yeah, we're 46th on the list. Good and Plenty, 86th.
That's dead last, right?
Yep, that is dead
They're
last.
They're like licorice flavored. I just feel like, and black licorice flavored too. Not even just licorice. Black licorice flavored. I mean, they're inedible.
Yep.
And at number 1B, I went with another low-hanging fruit, and that's candy corn.
I'm surprised that candy corn ranked as well as it did on this list at 67th. I think what I would say is that there must be some people out there that like candy corn because it continues to be produced. But
Good and Plenty is there might not. They're after candies that I have never heard of.
That is true.
Called a Nick L Nip.
Which may actually have worked to their benefit because, you know, maybe people, if they saw them against Good and Plenty, didn't have the visceral negative reaction that they do. Candy corn, some people must like it, but if you dislike it, you hate it, candy corn. You like actively despise it. It's candy corn and then Peeps in the spring. Fall and Peeps in the spring. They
Peeps
are like
are so bad.
Cousins somehow in terms of terribleness yet continued existence.
Okay, I had to include some honorable mentions.
Obviously.
My straight up Hershey's chocolate bars. Even more so with Hershey's dark chocolate, because dark chocolate's disgusting all around, but it's like, I've had chocolate, I'm over it.
That's interesting, by the way. I didn't realize that a quarter was ranked in this list.
Over a dime? They have a dime too. People are like, a quarter tastes significantly better than a dime.
I feel
2.5 times as good.
I mean, it says like which is the best to receive 1.5 times.
What is the math there?
2.5.
Okay.
I feel like a quarter is pretty much replacement level. You have to do better than that to be even worth having as candy at all.
Crunch bar.
I don't think crunch bars are horrible.
Not doing anything for me. Gobstoppers.
Yeah, I got nothing there.
Dots. I just added dots right now, but God, they're disgusting.
I agree with that.
And my secret one is Starburst.
Really?
Yeah, I hate Starburst.
Which there are some of in the kitchen.
There
right
are
now.
Not some of. There are thousands of. We are expecting so many trick-or-treaters here. I don't even, like, we're expecting way too many trick-or-treaters.
The first Halloween at your new house, I'm expecting no trick-or-treaters. I think last year I may literally have gotten none, but I still have to have candy, like, just in case someone comes. You don't want to get caught without it and then have to do, like, the lights-off routine.
That's what... Lights off routine.
What I prefer, honestly,
the whole lights off jig.
What I prefer, honestly, is when the Blazers play at home on Halloween, I could just go down to Portland and not even worry about it, and then wear my orange tie. It's nice. So,
well, if you live in Fairwood, Washington, and want like 60 Starbursts, come to my house.
There you go. There you go. All right, we got a lot of sports to talk, so let's get right into it, starting with the weekly update on the Sonics Arena. And it's actually a last week update on the Sonics Arena, because somehow I missed this until Brian Robinson wrote about it on Sonics Rising today, that last week the Seattle Times first reported, Jeff Baker, that the land use lawyer for the Soto group, Jack McCullough, had written a letter in response to the call for feedback on the environmental impact study to be done on Key Arena renovation. And most notably, had a number of things, basically outlined a number of things that he expected in an environmental impact study, making it along the same lines of what was done for Soto Arena when it was under consideration originally. Most notably, that it be evaluated as a public investment rather than a private investment. And this is relevant because it means that the environmental impact study would have to consider alternative sites for an arena, which would lengthen the process and would presumably make it, according to this article, make it difficult to complete it in enough time for building to start on the schedule that Oakview Group has proposed, which would allow the arena to open in the fall of 2020. So when the Soto Arena proposal was going through this similar process way back in 2012, starting back then, the labor union ILWU made the same request, and the city actually ultimately decided not to consider it a public investment, but did compromise by considering alternative sites in Seattle. They just didn't consider sites outside the city of Seattle. I think this is a fair request, even though it does contrast with Chris Hansen's public comments about, you know, not wanting to influence the decision on Key Arena, and most importantly, being open to a two arena solution, because, you know, obviously this would make it more difficult to renovate Key Arena. That being said, I don't think the city of Seattle should be worried whatsoever about the Oakview Group timeline. That's Oakview's business. The business for the city of Seattle is to make sure that this decision is vetted as thoroughly as possible, given that we're talking about an arena that is going to be in use for, you know, the terms of the lease, decades by definition. You should not be worrying about, oh, hey, can we have an NHL team here in 2020 or 2021? That 1 year is irrelevant in the grand scheme of things. So,
but it's still money.
What? The extra year being pushed back?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but that's up to Oakview to determine what it does to their plans. They've been trying to fast track this the entire time, and I think it's appropriate to go slowly, make a deliberate decision. And of course, let's remember, this is all contingent on the Seattle City Council approving the memorandum of understanding with Oakview Group basically as soon as they can do so on December 4th. There's not necessarily been indication from council that they're ready to move that quickly. They're, of course, busy right now with the budgetary process. So, you know, if that doesn't happen, then it's possible that this discussion is moot. It's also, they have not explained to us how they're going to resolve the NCAA tournament being held at Key Arena in 2019. But, you know, I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt that they're going to figure that one out. So the one thing I do wonder about, though, is I'm not sure if it is necessary to consider alternative sites, because of the fact that that has already been done as part of the Soto plan. So I'd be curious to hear more on that as we go forward about whether that, you know, basically can fulfill at least the spirit of the requirement, if not the letter of the requirement.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, not a huge update, but we'll continue to see how this progresses.
I thought the other interesting thing this week, and Brian linked to this as well in his post, was Bruce Harrell being asked about the Soto plan on the latest edition of the Seattle Channel's City Inside Out program dealing with the
city
council.
We're becoming so familiar with the local Seattle shows that we would never pay attention to otherwise.
Oh, I'm paying a lot of attention to local politics. I don't want you to smear me with that. Bruce Harrell's response.
His name is Mayor Bruce Harrell, by the way.
I mean, he's not the mayor.
He was. Was and forever will be. It's like president.
I think that the kinds of investment we're looking at and considering at Key Arena are very attractive. I supported the Soto Arena, but there was a lot of work that I thought they had to do on their part, and they're falling a little short. The lines are still open, and there's still life in that project, but I have to tell you there's a lot of good attention focused on Key Arena, and we'll see what happens. So that's, I think, a pretty good sign in terms of a vote in favor of Key Arena renovation. If Harrell, who was probably the staunchest Soto Arena supporter historically on the council, is speaking so positively about the Key Arena renovation option. So, again, we'll watch that. And we are coming up within 2 weeks now of within 2 weeks now of the election. So we'll see how that continues to shape things.
Well, let's talk about the basketball team that we will have in Seattle in the next 20 years.
We're going to talk about the Storm?
Oh, sorry.
I don't know if you saw, by the way, Storm forward Breanna Stewart with a very moving piece today talking about her experience of being molested as a child as part of the hashtag MeToo movement. So that was definitely worth a read and really powerful stuff from Breanna Stewart. I assume, though, you're referring to UW basketball, which is kicking off soon. The Husky men's team hosting an exhibition against St. Martin's this Thursday. And let me tell you, Seattle is a buzz talking about Husky men's hopes.
Seattle's
you can't go anywhere without hearing about it. Obviously, this will be Mike Hopkins' debut as head coach, so it'll be really interesting to watch from a strategic standpoint. I mean, you'd have to be at the arena. I, alas, will not be attending since I'll be down in Portland for the Blazers-Lakers game that night. Sounds like we're going to see a lot of zone from them, from Mike Hopkins' comments. No surprise, given his background at Syracuse. And I think the other thing we're looking to see in this opener and early in the season is who's going to step up as the go-to scorer for the Huskies with no Markelle Fultz. And I think Matisse Thybulle, after an off season where everyone has raved about his development, is probably the first contender to fill that role.
Absolutely. I mean, Thybulle, David Crisp is somebody who we'd like to see a little bit more from than a lot of question marks.
So the news less good for the women's program, which does not have an exhibition game, so they don't play until, I believe it's November 12th.
When is the first, talking at the Husky men's team, just for one more second, when is the first game that counts?
November 10th, they host Belmont.
Okay, so very soon.
So they will be losing to Belmont in their traditional losing their home opener to a non-power conference team.
I feel like there's a chance that this new defense sneaks up on people a little bit.
Belmont's really good. I don't know.
Maybe not Belmont, but maybe some other lesser teams. Look, St. Martin's, I feel like they've got a shot.
Yeah, I like their chances in that one. But bad news for the women's program is head coach Jody Wynn revealed last week at their media day that senior guard Natalie Romeo is out indefinitely with an undisclosed medical condition. She was the only returning starter for the Husky women, who lost three starters to graduation and then saw freshman point guard Arian McDonald transfer to Arizona. So it's going to be a very young team. I think the report was last week at one point they had six scholarship players available for practice. Could be a long season for Husky women's basketball.
For Husky basketball.
Yeah, that's very true. Husky, UW men were picked 10th in the Pac-12 in the preseason poll. We'll talk a little more about
that's
the,
not last.
The preview, I think, next week before they play a real game. Moving on, let's discuss the Sounders in between the two legs of their Western Conference semifinal matchup with
just
Vancouver.
As thrilling matchup as the Seahawks had yesterday.
You could not possibly get a less interesting soccer match.
Yes. This is exactly what they're trying to combat by doing the road goals.
Yeah, and they didn't. Partially because, obviously, the fact that Clint Dempsey was out, the Sounders went into, is expected, a much more defensive shell for this match, and were very successful at doing it. They cut out the Vancouver counter. Vancouver did not have a shot on goal in this game. The Sounders had the only shot on goal of the entire game, a Chad Marshall header.
One shot on goal for either team for the entire game.
That's true.
Wow.
Sanders also probably had the best chance to score when Vancouver nearly had an own goal by Kendall Waston.
That's how a goal would have happened in this one.
Not the winner. I mean, it was a good attack by them that forced Waston into that position. So the chance of advancing for 538 with this draw have gone from 67%. To 67%.
There it is. It's exactly, I was going to say that the Sounders won this game 0-0, but they didn't. They drew this game 0-0.
Yeah, I mean, they very much did. I mean, what 538 couldn't calculate in there is the fact that the Sounders were without Dempsey. They were so shorthanded. Osvaldo Alonso and Gustav Svensson were able to return off the bench in return roles, but, you know, you looked at the starting lineup for this match with Jordy Lehm out there.
Wow.
You know, it was like, oh, boy, I you're playing for a draw, and the Sounders got
yes.
it.
Yes. So, did not look like a playoff starting 11. What happened in the Portland versus Houston match that happened?
I have not looked that up. So I don't know if you're going to fill for a second here while I discuss.
Luka was watching it during halftime of the Monday Night Football game.
Nice.
Which is the only reason that I even knew that it was happening.
It was also a telltale
draw. There we go. Soccer, baby. It's MLF's playoff time. Oh my God.
A little more excitement in Toronto FC versus New York Red Bulls with a 2-1 Toronto win in New Jersey.
There's a little bit more excitement in the Eastern Conference.
So Dempsey is back for the return leg on Thursday at home. I think we may also see more minutes from Alonso or Svensson, possible that at least one of those guys and maybe both of them start, which would, you know, allow Christian Roldan to move into a bit of more of an attacking role if Brian Schmetzer wants it. Chad Marshall left this match in the late stages with what looked like a hamstring injury, but Schmetzer said after the game that it was just his hip tightening up and he'll be fine. So it sounds like he'll be available for this leg. Vancouver, you know, from in terms of in possible outcomes, has the advantage here because the Sounders need to win to advance. Or if Vancouver wins or draws with at least one goal, they will advance. And then if it's again scoreless through 90 minutes, they will then play extra time. That's the one scenario under the away goals tiebreaker where you have extra time. So basically the Sounders need to win, and they should be able to. They've been a dominant home team in recent weeks, including blowing out Vancouver 3-0 at home in their most recent meeting. And with Dempsey back in the lineup, you've got the firepower you need to put some goals on the board and win this series.
They're winning the series.
Wow, you're that confident? Do you want to talk about chances of victory?
I mean, the chances of victory are much higher than 66%. 67%, yeah.
I think they're like 70. I mean, like, first off, it's soccer.
I mean, yes, it's soccer.
A lot of things can happen.
They're going to win this game.
I feel pretty comfortable in their chances. Like I said, I think it was slightly better than a median outcome for them to draw 0-0 in Vancouver.
You're talking about a better team getting Clint Dempsey back, playing at home, just needing one goal. I mean, I suppose there's an outside chance that it's a little bit nerve-wracking at the end because of the way road goals work, that if they do give up a goal, then all of a sudden the Sounders need a little bit more.
Right, or even if they're up 1-0 in the late stages,
yes.
Then you're all poised on a knife edge at that point.
Yes, rather than it being 1-0 and feeling really confident, you know, there's still a chance that the Whitecaps can play soccer and, you know, get something miraculous. But I don't even think we're going to get in that situation. I bet it's 2-0 going into that.
I mean, it'll definitely be a more exciting match than the one in Vancouver. I can basically guarantee that. So hopefully people can get out to that. Sounders hustling hard to try to sell as many tickets to that as possible on a Thursday night when it looks like the weather is going to turn and it's going to be pretty rainy. So
great. Yeah. you know.
All right, well, looking forward to watching that one from Portland, where, as I mentioned, I'll be at the Blazers game. And then on Saturday, I will be back. Well, I'll be back Friday. I will be back as the Huskies host the rival Oregon Ducks.
Man, it's Oregon week. There's so much going on that it almost gets lost in the mix.
I know, which it shouldn't, because this is a big deal, especially because of the fact that the Huskies haven't beaten Oregon at home since, I'm going to look this up, but it's a long time.
Before I was born.
It's not that long. It's close, but it's not quite that long.
It's amazing how quickly we can take something like being heavily favored against Oregon for granted.
And probably too heavily favored. It was 2003 by the way, the last time the Huskies beat Oregon.
I was in high school.
Yeah, you weren't at UW yet. The Huskies are 21-point favorites in this game, and
Jesus,
I am perplexed by that.
I mean, they're assuming that Justin Herbert is not starting.
Clearly.
That is a Justin Herbert is not starting line.
All right, let's talk about the Huskies a little bit before we preview Oregon. Let's talk about last Saturday's game, because it was an interesting game, and it pretty much played out the way that we predicted that
Man,
it would.
I learned a lot about that game from us talking about it, and it played out exactly the way that we talked about it.
The Huskies ran for 333 yards in this game, 5.7 yards per carry, which is actually less than UCLA gives up on average in terms of yards per carry. More total yards than they give up.
It was, I mean, the Huskies clearly understood what the game plan should be going into this one, and they executed it, and they stuck with it also. There were times where it looked like the run game wasn't exactly going, but it was kind of like a little bit of 1 yards, 2 yards, and then boom, a big play.
Yeah, it was boom or bust, which is not necessarily what you expect against a bad run defense, but was the case here. So Jake Browning threw just 11 passes in this game, completing 8 of them.
Very committed to the game plan.
Completing 8 of them for 98 yards. Of those, 4 catches for 34 yards by receivers in this game. Half of them by true freshman Ty Jones, making his biggest impact of the season. Just 1 catch for Dante Pettis. The other thing we saw was strong special teams from the Huskies. Savon Ahmed getting a chance to return kicks.
Savon!
He was...
A toast to Savon Ahmed.
Yeah.
So good.
Coach Pete lived up to his vow to get Savon Ahmed more involved in this, and we saw an 82-yard kick return for him that came nearly
to the
house.
That's where he was really more involved. Who was returning kicks for the Huskies before this?
Sean McGrew, yeah.
Sean McGrew? They had Savon Ahmed just sitting there and waiting, and Sean McGrew is returning kicks?
It's a little like starting Tom Savage over Deshaun Watson.
Like, I mean, we're looking at this not just like, wow, it was amazing that he was returning kicks in this game. We're talking about for the next at least 3 seasons of Savon Ahmed.
Well, I don't know. At some point, he may get valuable enough offensively that you don't want him returning kicks. But
did you see him returning kicks?
I did.
Between Dante Pettis and Savon Ahmed, this is a dangerous team to kick the ball to.
They are. And by the way, Oregon ranked 91st in the country
in
special teams. Also, a toast to Tristan Vizcaino.
Oh, he's back,
three
baby.
Three on field goals. None of them longer than 31 yards.
Doesn't matter.
they couldn't hit short field goals against Arizona State. And had they been able to, we would probably still be looking at an undefeated team. So that's a thing to have. The bad news from Saturday's game, the sad news, Hunter Bryant with a leg injury. It looked ugly at the time. We knew it probably wasn't going to be good. And that general supposition confirmed today, as Coach Pete indicates, he'll be out a significant period of time due to that leg injury.
The year.
Yeah, I mean, realistically, he's not going to be back, which takes a big chunk out of the Huskies receiving game.
Yeah. Kind of keeps happening.
I mean, if I can be honest about something, I don't think Chico McClatcher is actually that good of a receiver. But yeah, I mean, the Husky pass game,
they got to get Savon split out wide more and actually catching passes. He can do it.
The Husky pass game has not had a lot of depth, has not been very dynamic, and
really are not working to stretch the field with Dante Pettis that much. I feel like maybe they're not even utilizing the weapons that they do have.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting to see if it's a little different. I think it made sense, the strategy they adopted against UCLA, to be conservative, try to run the football, take a play or two when you had it, which really their most success in the passing game was to running backs coming out of the backfield, screen passes, that sort of thing. So, all right, let's also one other note. The first release of the college football playoff rankings will be tonight if you are listening to this on Tuesday, or will already have happened if you're listening to this after Tuesday.
And I think those rankings are going to be pretty spooky for the Huskies.
Yeah, I mean, the good news is that there are many fewer undefeated teams now, and I think if the Huskies continue winning, they will climb in the rankings. They are probably lower than they should be right now, given that they are 7th in ESPN's Football Power Index at the moment and 12th in the polls. So
it's just they're in a tough place right now. I mean, things may look very different in the future, but given the losses and weak wins that the teams that they have coming up have had, there's not going to be a single game where that group is going to say, oh, but the Huskies beat this team.
Yes.
And there wasn't really that last year.
No.
But somehow they had positioned themselves almost, I think, by being one of the last undefeated teams. Because that's the thing, we talk about losing early is good. But also, if you're one of the last undefeated teams, they tend to kind of move you not that far. That's what it's all about, is the pollsters moving people. That's it, right?
But the College Football Playoff Committee has not always gone along with the pollsters. They are their own people. So it'll be interesting to see.
And they're going to like UW less than the polls are going to like UW.
You think so?
I think so. I think they end up being 12th or lower.
Okay. We'll see.
But so what you look at is you have a Wazoo team that looks pretty beaten down. You have a USC team that had a devastating loss against Notre Dame if the Huskies were to even play them. You have Stanford, who without Bryce Love is beating Oregon State by a point at the end of the game.
I think people can adjust for the fact that Bryce Love, assuming he will be available for the Husky game,
you're
in a couple
expecting
weeks.
Too much. You're expecting people to pay way more attention to the Pac-12 than they actually are.
I think people are aware that Bryce Love didn't play in that game. I think that information is readily available.
I think if the Huskies win out, there is a less than 60% chance that they make the college football playoff.
538 continues to indicate an 80% chance of them making the playoff if they win out. But you know what? First, let's win some games and then worry about that.
Always trust those 538 percentages.
Too much discussion about that right now. You understand how percentages work. They were much lower than anyone else.
Look, I was talking at Good and Plenty's. 21%.
Let's talk about Oregon. So why is it such a big deal if Justin Herbert plays in this game? He's been out now with a fractured clavicle for a few weeks here, warmed up before last week's game, and was considered to be available in the case of an emergency, but did not play as Oregon beat Utah behind 12 passing attempts from their quarterback, Braxton Burmeister, and 47 rushing attempts in that game. So a very similar strategy that UW employed, although in their case, a little bit less by choice. So Herbert, in the games he played, completed 68% of his passes for 10 yards per attempt and two interceptions in 126 attempts. Burmeister, presumably no relation to former Husky men's basketball player Brandon
Burmeister.
I was
going to say no relation.
57% completion percentage for 4.7 yards per attempt, which is an impossibly low number, and 5 interceptions in 63 attempts, which is a 5 times higher interception rate than Justin Herbert. And if you want to get to the bottom line here, so I went and looked up their Sagarin rating based on the opponents they played and the outcome of those games with Herbert, including the Cal game where he started and was knocked out during that game. With him, they have a 91.4 rating, which would be basically the same as UW's Sagarin rating in the predictor model of 91.8 and put them in the top 10 in the country. Without Herbert, their rating is 63.4, 28 points worse, and that's equivalent to Utah State.
Man.
So he makes a really, 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 really big difference.
So the difference between Justin Herbert and Braxton Burmeister is we're talking Rodgers to Brett Hundley. We're talking Reese's Peanut Butter Cups to Kit Kats.
I don't know if I would say that, but yes.
We're talking Reese's Peanut Butter Cups to candy corn between these two quarterbacks.
All right, I can get on board with that. Here's what Willie Taggart had to say at his press conference on Monday about Herbert. If he's ready this week, we'll play him. And if not, then we won't. But we're going to continue to practice him and let him continue to get better. But we're not going to put him out there in harm's way and let him re-injure himself, which is too many buts for one.
There's too much going on in the statement.
Also, the big joke is about him drinking milk so that the clavicle will heal more quickly. So I don't know
how
much.
Know about recovery water?
I don't know how
much. Cures head injuries like instantly.
Let's be careful with that one. I don't know how much milk that's going to take, but he's been drinking it, and it's been helping, and he's been healing real quick. Also, this clavicle injury is on his left arm, so it's not his throwing shoulder. That contrasts with the aforementioned Aaron Rodgers, who this time broke his right shoulder, as opposed to breaking his left collarbone when he was out and was able to return during the season a few years ago.
Reading between the lines of the statement, it's kind of complicated because part of it, you're like, I might play. And then part of it, you're like, no way. But just seeing, we don't want to put him in harm's way and let him re-injure himself. I understand this is Oregon UW. It's a big game. But if you're taking your potential star quarterback, your quarterback who people were talking about as a Heisman candidate at the beginning of the season, and throwing him out there on the road against one of the best defenses in the Pac-12, that might be something that would be constituted as putting him in harm's way.
Right. This is not a soft landing for Justin Herbert. So we'll see. Obviously, Vegas seems to think that he is not playing in this game. Elsewhere, Royce Freeman is still awesome. He's averaging 6 yards per carry and 122 yards per game this season. And then senior Kenny Benoit is also a threat. He had 9 carries for 71 yards last week against Utah and 18 for 138 against Cal when Freeman was knocked out of that game, along with Herbert. Defensively, Oregon...
I'm so ready to draft Royce Freeman in fantasy football next year.
Defensively, I'm surprised that Oregon is only rated 38 in FPI or 43 in FPI. They're actually rated slightly better on offense despite the Herbert injury than on defense. I can't quite figure this one out. I guess it must be a strength of schedule issue because they're only allowing 3.3 yards per carry on the ground. That's the second best in the conference behind the Huskies. And they're fourth best in yards per attempt allowed in terms of passing at 6.6. They also lead the Pac-12 with 30 sacks so far this season. So this is a solid Oregon defense that could be difficult for UW to score against.
And is that what Willie Taggart does? Does he come in as a defensive coach?
I'm actually not sure about that. That's a good question.
Let's say that's true. but there's a lot of talent on the defensive side of the ball for Oregon, and they're playing well. This is the type of game where I don't think UW straight up is going to dominate on offense. I think if they do blow this one open, it's going to be because of mistakes that Oregon makes on offense or in special teams.
Yep.
It's going to be the type of game where, and the Huskies have done this a lot lately, where they're able to just kind of take advantage of these kind of little stupid mistakes and score points and points and points and points until Oregon's in a situation where they're needing to pass the ball with Brandon, with
Braxton,
cousin Braxton, with Braxton Burmeister. And that is going to be a very bad situation for Oregon.
Yeah, I mean, actually, I'd say in many ways it's more similar to what we think of with the Seahawks, where if they can get a lead and put another team in a situation where they become, you know, one-dimensional and are passing all the time. I mean, I think of like the Colts game earlier this year. That's kind of the kind of game I'm thinking of here.
I'm nervous about this Huskies offense, though. If this ends up being a straight-up game or a game that Herbert plays and they need to score, I just don't know exactly where that's going to come from. Watching them run for 330 yards this last week, I was somehow still unimpressed.
I mean, they did what they had to do.
They did what they had to do, but they looked unable to pass the ball against UCLA.
I don't know if they were unable to pass. I mean, again, he completed 8 of 11 passes for like almost 9 yards per attempt. Like those are good numbers, although his QBR was like 30 because most of it was yards after the catch.
But they also boom or bust plays just don't leave you feeling that confident. You feel much more confident in a running game if they're picking up 7-8 yards per carry. These plays where it's 1 yards, 2 yards, and then 30, it's not that repeatable.
Yeah, it might be. Especially if you're going up against Braxton Burmeister. Chances of victory, let's do both if Herbert plays and if he doesn't.
I think it's a big difference. I think it's 90-70%.
I think it's 90-60.
Wow. Almost a 50-50 game for Herbert plays.
I'm applying.
We're talking about this is his first game back, too.
True. I'm applying a little just general fear of Oregon.
You really should have that.
Yeah. They've been beating them since 2003. That was 14 years ago.
I mean, they hadn't beaten them on the road for a long time, also last year.
And then.
What was the final of that one? They scored 70.
Yeah, they did. 70-21. Is that right?
That seems about right.
That was good. Let's do that again. I like that song. Let's hear it again.
I am not looking forward to the Oregon fans of the game.
Do you think there will be as many of them as in past years?
I mean, probably not as many as in past years, but there's still going to be a lot.
This game is a sellout. What a strange concept.
Have they announced the time for this?
Is it 7:45? Yeah, 7 p.m.
7 p.m.
It's on FS1.
Okay.
Which also the Sounders match on Thursday will also be on FS1 at 7:30. So
should we skip airing of grievances this week? If you listen to the Seahawks-Texans recap, you heard my grievances.
And if you listen to the candy section, you heard his grievances about what candy you're trying to give him at Halloween. Yeah, we still got a lot to talk about with the Seahawks. So let's get into that. And let's start with talking about the Dwayne Brown trade.
Dwayne Brown! How have we waited this long? Oh, my God.
The Seahawks have a quality offensive lineman. It's been a while.
Not even just a quality offensive lineman, a quality left tackle, too.
Yeah. We talked on the Sunday pod about the Russell Okung era, to which some people took exception. But now it's the Dwayne Brown era. I'm declaring it.
Wow.
So another aggressive move here by John Schneider in the Seahawks front office. It's possible that they're buying my theory that, you know, just like you never know when the world might end. So go all aggressively in on this season to have traded now second round picks in consecutive drafts, both 2018 and 2019, plus now a fifth round pick in 2018. I do feel like a little bit of this is them paying to get off Jeremy Lane's salary for the rest of the season.
Yeah, they don't like Jeremy Lane.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they dislike Jeremy Lane, but just he's been replaced. Justin Coleman is great. I feel very good about the depth at cornerback right now, especially DeShon Shedd could come back.
Jeremy Lane doesn't even register in this trade for me.
It's not like trading Jermaine Kearse, I'll put it that way.
So can you tell us a little bit about Dwayne Brown?
So he's been a very good, consistent player for the Texans over several years. You look at his 2016 stats from the Football Outsiders Almanac, and it's safe to call them the envy of Seahawks fans. Like, they almost brought a tear to my eye looking at them when Vince Verhaeghe of Football Outsiders tweeted them out here from this year's Football Outsiders Almanac. He had one penalty
all season,
and he played 12 games last year. He did miss four. He had no sacks allowed.
No sacks!
Is that legal? Is that allowed? Is that a thing?
And I think he allowed how many pressures?
Not sure about that, actually.
Like 6 run pressures and 5 pass pressures? Something in that range.
Oh, yeah. Those are blown blocks.
Oh, okay. Blown blocks.
Is what Football Outsiders calculates. Yeah, I had 6 blown pass blocks, which is an incredibly low number for a left tackle, traditionally going up against the opponent's best pass rushing threat. You okay? Do you need a moment?
I mean, John Schneider is setting himself up for the Seattle Sports Star of the Year.
I mean, it still has to all come together.
He's in position right now, though. The Seahawks love these huge trades. They don't want to trade. They kind of love a lot of trades.
Yeah.
Which we should talk about Garoppolo for a second, too. But the Seahawks really love these blockbuster trades. And there have been so many of them at this point where they've traded for superstars. It's kind of amazing.
I really...
Like, this is exactly what fans want. They do the little stuff. You pick up Justin Coleman kind of for free. But then also you go out, boom, there's Sheldon Richardson. Boom, there's Dwayne Brown. Back in the day, boom, Percy Harvin. Boom, Marshawn Lynch.
I mean, the interesting thing is like how specifically fan service these two trades have been this year.
Boom, Jimmy Graham.
It's like, but yes. People were like asking for Sheldon Richardson. You know, thinking, oh, Jets, you know, tanking the season. Sheldon Richardson. And then, oh, Dwayne Brown holding out. Seahawks trade for him. And then they do it.
They do it.
Despite us talking with Brady Henderson about how unlikely it was for them to make this trade.
Yeah, they kind of made it work. So do you want to talk about this from the cap perspective also?
Well, we don't know exactly how they've made this work. They said that, you know, the comment from Schneider was just, we're inheriting his contract, which that's the definition of a trade. That's how that works. Yeah. Presumably.
We have traded for goods and services.
Exchanged goods and services. So Jeremy Lin getting his $2 million base salary off the books helps to some extent. The assumption generally on the internet is that they will convert Dwayne Brown's remaining base salary from this year to a signing bonus, which means then it will be over the two remaining seasons on his contract, both 2017 and 2018, which does start to make it a little trickier to re-sign Sheldon Richardson next offseason.
And the plan,
raises some questions there.
The plan would maybe be to extend Dwayne Brown.
That is a possible consideration. It seems unlikely that it would be in an extending trade, to use the NBA parlance. It seems more likely that it would be something that would happen afterwards. And you wouldn't necessarily want to extend him too long. I mean, Dwayne Brown is 32 at this point, so, you know, he's not going to play forever. But, you know, I think when you look at the success that the Rams had bringing in a much older offensive lineman, Andrew Whitworth, it's, you know, possibly something the Seahawks are looking to emulate there.
Eddie Lacy's about to be Todd Gurley.
You know, you're excited. Loyal third Pelton brother Zach Whitman tweeted the idea of a possible offensive line of Brown at left tackle, Jokel when he comes back of his surgery at left guard, Justin Britt obviously at center.
Which the timeline for Jokel was maybe 2 to 4, no, like four weeks.
Five, 4 to 5 weeks.
But that was going into the bye, and we've already played 2 of those games.
I mean, he had a surgery at the end of the bye week, so I don't know. I think we're still looking probably at another, I think at least through the Arizona game, so the next 2 games at least.
Still not that long without him.
And then potentially Ethan Posick at right guard after he's been pretty effective at left guard could be a long-term solution there. Now that, you know, it looks, we'll see whether Jokel is back next year. He is, of course, a free agent as well.
Maybe they'll find a way to figure it out. But first, I think Jokel is going to be very expensive.
That is possible.
And
although
also
the fact that he's coming off 2 knee surgeries in many years limits his expensiveness.
I don't know. The experienced offensive linemen are an expensive commodity. I think that this trade means that the percentage chance of them re-signing Luke Jokel before this trade, I thought was pretty high, and after it is quite a bit lower.
I do wonder what's going to happen with George Fant. I mean, I think it makes sense if you bring in Brown and don't alter his contract, don't extend him. Like, it makes sense to just give Fant 2018 to work his way back into form and then say, we're going to expect you to come in 2019 and win back the job.
We'll see about that. I mean, I was wondering about George Fant earlier, but also I was just excited about the idea of depth.
Right, that's true. Or he could be a consideration at right tackle where, you know, Jermaine Ifedi has shown promise, but also is, was it Barnwell that tweeted that he has, like, more penalties than the number of entire offensive lines in the league this season.
It's not great. Oh, man. Okay, so wait, you were going through the line that Zach Whitman proposed.
Yeah, and then Ifedi at right tackle.
Who's the right guard?
Well,
Ibushi slash... Oh, Posick at right guard. Okay,
once Joko comes back.
That was, to me, one of my first responses was, I'm excited for this year, but I'm also excited for next year, right? Because we've talked about how important consistency is on an offensive line. And when you look at that line, I'm imagining it with Posick probably being at left guard, and then maybe some combination of a brought back Ibushi or Glowinski or something at right guard. Basically, that's the only position you really need to figure out, though. Like, Ethan Posick is going to have to settle into another position because we've got a center. He's not going to be a center.
He's been effective so far at left guard. I think you feel good about how he's played the last two games. And the other aspect of the timing of this trade, by the way, it was not quite as many as entire team. Barnwell noted that the Washington professional football team who the Seahawks faced this week in Cincinnati, they have 16. Oh, that's no, I'm sorry. That wasn't offensive line. That's total offensive.
Total penalties.
They have 16. Jermaine Fetty has 11 penalties.
Good God.
So that's not great.
Okay, so I'm also...
But
just,
we're being positive here.
I'm excited about this from the perspective of, I think that Dwayne Brown is going to just bring this whole unit together. This might be expecting too much.
Well, that's the Whitworth hope.
But I was thinking about this. This might be a crazy thing to say, but sometimes when I play basketball, there's this one like older dude who comes and is so good at communicating. He's just talking the entire time, right? He's like, go there, do this, do this. I mean, and when he does that, I do everything so well.
I mean, I'm not that old.
It's just like I do everything exactly right when he's saying that, and I feel like having a player like Dwayne Brown, who's a 32-year-old offensive lineman, when the most experienced lineman that they have right now is Justin Brent, who's still very young.
Yeah,
it's going to be a game changer. He's immediately going to walk in the door. You saw it at Houston, where like he's holding out until half the season basically and is the leader of the team instantly. How did that even happen when he's one of the most outspoken? But it was clear that Dwayne Brown was speaking on behalf of the Texans as a team instantly. Yep. When he walked in the door.
Yeah, I mean, I remember talking to a coach in the WNBA about this at one point, not a Storm coach, believe it or not, but like they had a player at power forward who had a tough time remembering plays, and it was like really important to have a veteran center who could go out and explain to her the play and make sure that she ran the right play. And it's not exactly the same in football, because obviously you're not like drawing up plays in the huddle in the same way, but I think it's a similar kind of concept.
Yeah, I really believe that Dwayne Brown is going to be very important for Jermaine Ifedi. So I'm curious to look at kind of how the, I mean, it's going to be, I don't know exactly what stat we're going to use to judge the offensive line from here going forward, but I wanted the next couple of weeks kind of look at it as the pre-Dwayne Brown and post-Dwayne Brown era.
I mean, the one interesting thing, especially given, you know, the way that Tom Cable generally thinks about offensive line play, is the fact that Dwayne Brown generally has historically been considered a better pass blocker than a run blocker. So I don't know if he's going to like solve things there, but also Risa Oyombo whiffed on Jadeveon Clowney a lot on Sunday, and I think that was a primary driver of why this trade occurred when it did.
But also, I like the idea of moving Oyombo to a backup. Yeah. Having him as somebody who we know can play multiple positions, he's a good person to have around and will get more experience in the system. I just really like everything about this trade. I kept thinking about it being like, oh man, that and this. And you look at the left side of the line with all of a sudden when you've got Dwayne Brown, Luke Jokel, and Justin Britt, you're like, this kind of, it's just a little smidgen of the mid-2000s. It's not quite that. Dwayne Brown isn't Walt Jones.
But could it
Luke Jokel certainly is not Steve Hutchinson.
It just has to be 2012. That's all it has, or 2013. That's all it has to be. Like this
looks like it's going to be a competent offensive line from here on out.
The Okung Unger era.
Man, I just feel so good about this, and I feel good about it. We're going to go in next year with, I'm going to do a giant knock on wood here. There's a good chance that we go into next season having the line pretty much settled.
That would be nice.
Where we, in the preseason, we can talk about other things.
We'll still tell you about the line.
We don't have to have offensive line breakdowns every single week because we just don't even know. I mean, I can't believe how much this one trade can change the entire complexion of the line.
So all that being said, I think Ryan Kerrigan is still going to have a huge game against the Seahawks.
Do you?
Yeah, because he's a left outside linebacker. He's not going to be going against Dwayne Brown.
It's going to turn on quickly for Ifedi.
did you want to get my trade grades for this one?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I'm giving this one the classic Kevin Belton don't take a side. B for both teams.
For both teams. How is this a B for the Texans? Because I saw some Texans opinions that were very strongly negative.
Yeah, I mean, look, Dwayne Brown would have been an upgrade over their tackle play the rest of the season. But A, they were able to win three games without him. And B, like, you're shedding a sizable salary for next season. You have a lot more cash space. Plus, you get the second round pick. It's like I always talk about, like, you know, you don't trade for the player, you trade for the contract. And from the Seahawks standpoint, I still think Brown can bring enough value to be worth that. But from Houston's standpoint, I think it's going to work out down the road.
I agree that there are contracts that make more sense for different teams. And the Seahawks are going all in on this season. But we need to talk for 1 second.
I mean, Deshaun Watson's also a rookie. Like, this shouldn't be the season that Texans are like, we got to win this year.
Nah.
Like, no, you got time. Will Fuller's in his second year. DeAndre Hopkins is right in the middle of his prime. J.J. Watt's injured right now. Yeah. This is not the year for Houston.
They've got a window, though. If we have some advice for Houston, it's win when Deshaun Watson's on that rookie contract.
That's fair, but they've got 4 years. And then, I mean, you know, he'll become much more expensive on the option, but a fifth year on that rookie option, whereas, you know, Wilson was renegotiated after three. So
we got to talk about Jimmy G heading west.
I don't feel good about this. I'm not excited about this.
You're not excited about this?
Well, it's like a Seahawks fan. No, I think that Jimmy Garoppolo for a second round pick is pretty good value for the Niners. Unless he's just a complete Patriots creation, which is possible. But
I mean, I don't know. I guess I wouldn't say that I'm excited about it. I'm more excited about it just from the standpoint of things happening in the NFL.
I mean, it's interesting, yes.
Right? And this is only the day before the trade deadline. More could happen on the day of the trade deadline.
I suppose that's true. There's already two bigger trades than you usually get at the trade deadline.
Yeah, it's amazing.
I mean, when you look at next year's quarterback crop, I think the guy that we're going to talk about in a second here, Kirk Cousins, is a much better prospect, but he would have been so much more expensive than Garoppolo.
When is Garoppolo renegotiating his contract, though?
He's a free agent this year, but he's not going to cost nearly as much as Cousins, is what I'm saying.
I mean, and Cousins, he obviously won't cost as much as Cousins, but depending on these last 8 games,
he could, yeah.
He could make a lot of money.
We'll see if they sign him to an extension before.
And he'll
that.
Be a restricted free agent?
I don't know exactly off the top of my head.
If not, why would they trade a second round pick for him?
I mean, they're definitely planning to have him long term. I mean, they may extend it. The other thing is Cousins is much older than your San Francisco core. I think Garoppolo makes more sense with the timetable for the 49ers. So,
but a drafted...
But then when you look at him compared to, like, you know, okay, maybe San Francisco might go winless. They might get the number one pick in the draft.
Yes.
Although the chances... I'm in the scenario where they hadn't traded for Garoppolo, their chances are much lower of going winless now. Are you feeling really good about any quarterbacks in college football right now?
I still think Lamar Jackson could be good.
I mean, I think he definitely could be good, but he's not like an... would you rather have Lamar Jackson and a second-round pick or Jimmy Garoppolo and the number one or number two pick? Or maybe even now, let's say number five. Let's say they win that many games.
They're still keeping their first-round pick.
That's what I'm saying. So Jimmy Garoppolo in that pick...
Okay.
Or Lamar Jackson in a second round pick.
Oh, that's an interesting proposition.
That's the way you have to think about it.
But also, you have to think about it as, we don't know what Jimmy Garoppolo is going to be paid, but he's not going to be a rookie contract quarterback.
Yeah, but the number two pick is still a pretty sizable contract. I don't think it's not generating as much value as, say, getting Deshaun Watson at number 12.
You might have talked me into this.
Yeah.
For the 49ers.
I don't know why I had to talk you into it. Let's go Niners. It's not what we're talking about.
But having him in the division, I mean, this is a huge deal for us in the division, because this is a quarterback that we're going to see a lot.
Yeah, including in a few weeks here.
If he's good...
The 49ers' chances of beating the Seahawks in a few weeks went up substantially, you have to think.
Maybe. I mean, I still personally...
We're taking the alternative is C.J. Beathard.
Okay, well, sure.
The alternative is C.J. Beathard. Colin Kaepernick is not walking through that door. Although, if he's walking through the door in New England, wouldn't that be fascinating?
Oh, no. Man.
Obviously, they're signing Brian Hoyer.
They should have just traded him. They want him on a new deal.
He'll make the minimum as opposed to the $3 million he was making in San Francisco.
God, I love Brian Hoyer as a backup.
Yeah.
But, I mean, for the Seahawks, this is a trade that if Jimmy Garoppolo is good, it's an issue. I'm just not necessarily convinced that Jimmy Garoppolo is good.
We'll see. I don't know. I mean, he does have a certain Matt Flynn to him.
He's got a certain Matt Flynn sheen to him.
He really does.
I mean, it could
Matt
be.
Matt Flynn is so good for the Packers.
It's probably worth the risk, though, for the 49ers.
Yeah.
And actually, the good thing is that they did it now. Here's another art pro for it. Man, we should just do a 49ers podcast. But the good thing is they get to see him for 8 weeks. If he really sucks, they can just let him walk. and go and draft a quarterback with that pick.
Although I think they are going to sign him. And that is my hot take, that this 49ers will sign him to an extension within the next couple weeks here.
Well, anyway, I'm fascinated to watch him. And having the 49ers coming up in a few weeks, it's going to be very interesting.
Yeah. All right. Should we talk about this week's game?
Yes.
Let's talk about Washington's injuries, because it's a long list. Let me get through this. All right. So they've got two front seven players, Jonathan Allen and Trent Murphy, on IR. I guess three front seven players, because last week they put Mason Foster, the ex-Husky, who's playing middle linebacker for them, also on IR. He's going to have season-ending surgery. They played last week without Trent Williams and Brandon Scherff on their offensive line. Trent Williams, of course, being a fixture at left tackle and Scherff at right guard. did you just correct this fellow to Bashaud Breeland?
I just want to make sure you didn't pronounce his name incorrectly.
I know what his name is, even if I typed it wrong. They're also without their backup left tackle.
I'm trying to protect you here. I'm like Dwayne Brown over here.
So they were starting last week their third left tackle, TJ Clemmings, a Minnesota cast-off. And then he left Sunday's game with a sprained ankle, which forced them to move who was the guy who was replacing Scherff at right guard to the left tackle. Like, things are not going
great
for
the Washington. Can we interest you in Ariso Diombo?
Maybe Matt Tobin. Jordan Reed, their star tight end, who has not had a great season, but is a tremendous talent and has been great in the past. He left Sunday's game with a hamstring injury, is not expected to play this week. Their backup tight end, Niles Paul, was already out with a concussion. He's week to week. Defensive tackle, Matt Yenotis. Yenotis?
That can't be the way that's pronounced.
Has 3.5 sacks, is undergoing surgery for a broken bone in his hand, so he's out this week. Bashaud Breeland, whose name I do not know how to pronounce, even if I don't know how to spell it, missed last week's game. And then Jamison Crowder at wide receiver, who also has not been super great this year, injured his hamstring and suffered a lower leg contusion last week, so his status is uncertain.
Man, that offensive line, I mean, we were talking, whomever they're starting at left tackle, going against the Seahawks D-line in Seattle, it's not going to be pretty.
Dwight Freeney, more than one sack this week.
Oh, there we go. Prediction.
So they went a four-week stretch. They went a four-week stretch in the middle of the season with four sacks total of Kirk Cousins. The last 2 weeks, they've had four sacks in each of those games.
Man.
So a real opportunity for the Seahawks defense playing at home to wreak some havoc, I would say. And that's important because of the fact that when Kirk Cousins is able to throw the football, he's really good. Like, Cousins has become a good player. He's sixth in QBR this year. Three spots ahead of Russell Wilson, who's in ninth after that big performance on Sunday. He's number four in completion percentage, number four in yards per attempt, and near the top 10, like right behind Wilson in terms of interception rate. I think the one reason he's a little lower in QBR is a lot of those yards have come to Chris Thompson, and he gets a lot more of the credit. Thompson gets a lot more of that credit in QBR than Cousins does for passing the ball to him out of the backfield.
Because there's so many yards after the catch there.
So Thompson is not only averaging 4.9 yards per carry, which he should just be playing at running back all the time for them. I believe that Rob Kelly also left last week's game with an injury, although I don't think he's on the injury report anymore going forward.
Scored a touchdown in fantasy.
Far and away number one among NFL running backs in receiving DR.
Chris Thompson is like low-key one of my favorite players in the NFL.
He's averaging better than 11 yards per target this season.
By the way, saying that, I meant to say during the Dwayne Brown segment, is that the Seahawks made this trade load key to just justify running the ball more for the next few weeks.
Well,
anyway.
Chris Thompson, rich man's J.D. McKissick, or a healthy C.J. Prosise.
He's better than C.J. Prosise. He's good. Chris Thompson is good.
Excuse me, are you saying that C.J. Prosise is not good? Because every time C.J. Prosise is healthy, he's great. And those three plays are so good. Look, I believe C.J. Prosise is going to stay healthy at some point.
Just watch the tape.
I really believe in that.
If you watch that one New England game.
So they should be playing him a lot more because Samaje Perine, which is not how that name looks like it should be pronounced. It's really just an unpleasant way to pronounce it. Perine sounds much better. Was tied for last in the NFL in DR among running backs entering last week. So that's not been going super great. He's averaging 3.0 yards per carry. Rob Kelly, 3.8 yards per carry, although he's at least been a bit more consistent. And then, you know, the interesting thing is like how dependent their passing game is on Thompson. And then Vernon Davis, of all people.
Yes. Vernon Davis has been good.
A late career renaissance in Washington, averaging 14.2 yards per target this season, whereas you look at Crowder, is at 6.3 yards per target, and then Jordan Reed is at 6.0 yards per target. The other guy who's been effective, is reasonably effective, is Terrell Pryor, despite the fact that Kirk Cousins does not seem to like throwing him the ball.
He just hates Terrell Pryor.
Well, I think he's trying to take his job at quarterback.
But so it's going to be very huge for the Seahawks defense to stop Chris Thompson. Yeah. Because there aren't a lot of other options there.
And I think, yeah, they've got the ability to really focus in on Chris Thompson, given that lack of other options.
But it'll be huge for them to just make tackles, because he's going to get the ball on the edge.
One of the disappointing things is the fact that Bradley McDougal probably is going to be at safety this game, you know, if Earl Thomas is unable to go. Because otherwise, I think you would see McDougal play a lot at linebacker to match up with Chris Thompson.
That'd be very interesting. But also, I'm happy that if Earl was to miss this game, I like seeing Bradley McDougal back there.
Fascinating idea. What if they play Chedrick Thompson sometimes at free safety and then play McDougal in that role is like against Thompson?
They probably will.
I don't know if I would say they would probably will, but that's just tuck that away is a possible consideration.
It's going to be on everybody to make tackles, though. It's going to be on Justin Coleman to make tackles. It's going to be on Shaq Griffin to make tackles. It's going to be on both of the safeties. It's going to be on KJ Wright. There are going to be situations where Chris Thompson, I mean, he's not going to touch the ball a ton of times, but if they bring him down, then we don't even have to worry about Chris Thompson.
Yeah.
And also, you know, what they can do, look, statistically, a lot of that happened with Brandon Scherff and Trent Williams.
Yep.
And space matters, but also that blocking up in front of him matters. I've seen some plays where Chris Thompson has the right blocks and can make those plays. But if he's working with a fourth, fifth string off at left tackle, then things are different.
So on the other side of the football, Kerrigan has 6 sacks this season. As I mentioned, he's going up against Jermaine Fetty. So, yeah, going to probably want to give him a little bit of help on that side of the football. But he seems like the Washington front seven pass rusher who will get the film treatment for dominating the Seahawks offensive line this week. The Washington Memorial.
Hoping that trend breaks.
Yeah, we'll see. The Washington pass defense, it's interesting. They've been excellent so far this season against outside wide receivers. 4th against number 1 wide receivers, 2nd versus number 2 wide receivers. Now, that doesn't count last week when Breland did miss the game, so obviously they're not as good without him. Their vulnerable spot, their soft underbelly, 28th in DVOA against tight ends. Houston was very good coming into this game at covering tight ends, and still Jimmy Graham got loose multiple times in the second half after not really being targeted much early, which is sort of consistent with that. So we'll see if that happens again.
But Dallas went into that game kind of wanting to run the ball against Washington last week. They ran the ball with Ezekiel, knowing that it was his last game of the year, or at least his last game for a while.
Back for the fantasy playoffs. Don't worry about it.
But they ran Zeke 33 times in that game and really did not put the ball. They had a Husky-like game plan. I mean, 22 throws for Dak Prescott where he was just 14 of 22. You can kind of tell that this is a good Washington secondary.
Yeah.
And Russell Wilson can throw for 452 yards this week.
I think that is safe to assume on multiple levels that he will probably not need to throw for 452 yards. But as Pete Carroll said on Monday on the coach's show, it's nice to know he can do it if he has to.
Yeah, it sure is. But so what does it mean when we look at this game plan wise when you have a team like the Seahawks who can't run the ball and a team like Washington who's good at stopping the pass?
I mean, they're just above average at stopping the pass. Let's not get too far. And again, you know, the injuries may change that a little bit. I don't know if you're going to see the same pass rush because they don't have the interior pressure. It was Yiannotis and Jonathan Allen who are really responsible for providing that at the defensive tackle position. Obviously, Trent Murphy is out, so that's a big loss for them. They're not as strong on the right side. You know, if Dwayne Brown is able to step in effectively, you know, maybe that side isn't creating problems for Russell Wilson. I still think this is a game where the Seahawks should be able to pass the ball.
Okay. And it may be that Dallas game plans differently going into Washington vis-a-vis a game where they're coming here going against the Seahawks coming off this monster performance by Russell.
Yeah, and I think it's also Dallas wanted to control the game, keep Cousins off the field. I mean, I don't think that's a bad game plan. The Seahawks probably can't count on being able to do that. I do think they'll run.
No running back is going to run the ball 33 times in this one.
Well, yes, that's pretty safe to assume. I also think it's safe to assume that the Seahawks running backs will get more than 5 yards combined this week. So that's my little tip to those of you entering the contest.
They're going to make regression in the mean work for them. Dwayne Brown is going to make it work for him because there's no chance they run for less than 5 yards.
Yeah. Yeah, he'll get all the credit.
No, there's a chance, actually.
There's a chance. It passes the any chance rule. Anything else to say about this matchup?
What about special teams?
Yeah, I mean, there's they're somewhat below average, have been particularly poor on punt returns so far this year. So watch that. They're bad punt returns. Although, actually, I think it's Jamison Crowder has been returning punts. So if he doesn't play, I'm not sure to whom that responsibility would fall.
I think we might see a return to an ugly Seahawks game in this one.
Yeah, I mean, I think people think that this, you know, 41-38 shootout, that it's more permanent than it really is. Like, there are games every once in a while where this will happen, and then the Seahawks get back to playing their style.
So, I mean, it was great to see what they did, but I just don't. I'm not holding my breath. You know, had that quote in the recap that I would like to see an offense where we were surprised every time they ran the ball.
That's just not going to happen.
You should have responded with an, oh, honey.
Oh, honey. Oh, that's sweet.
But
so naive.
I think the defense probably will look a little bit better in this one. Like, I mean, Kirk Cousins doesn't have the same kind of element that Deshaun Watson does. He's still a scary quarterback, though.
He's a good quarterback. But yeah, there's not, you know, they're not going to be motioning. I don't know who even would be healthy. I guess Terrell Pryor into the backfield and running the option, triple option RPO with Terrell Pryor and Kirk.
I'm trying to think about the quarterbacks that they have on the schedule. And it's like when you look at the best quarterbacks they've faced all year, you've got Rodgers.
Yep.
Watson.
Yeah.
Is Kirk Cousins the third best quarterback that they faced all year? Looking at the future schedule, you've got Dak, Carson Wentz, but who else?
Well, I mean, Carson Wentz is the MVP of the NFL, so presumably he must be higher on that list. I mean, Mariota is a very good quarterback.
He's not as good as these dudes, though.
Probably not, although, you know, I think we're downgrading him a little bit because he's been playing with a strained hamstring for a few weeks, so he hasn't had the run threat in the same way. But yeah, Jacoby Brissett, Jared Goff, Eli, I would take the.
Even looking at the future schedule, I mean, I guess Matt Ryan is still a good quarterback, but as far as the season goes, Kirk Cousins could be the third or fourth best quarterback that they face all year.
Yeah, it's possible.
So there's definitely a reason to be scared. The Seahawks are lucky to be facing Washington at home, and they're lucky to be facing Washington with so many injuries, especially on that offensive line, where it's like Kirk Cousins might not look as good as he should, partially because he doesn't have time to get the ball off.
I would say, given those injuries, I'm surprised that the line isn't a little higher.
Really?
It's Seahawks -7.5, which is, you know, basically 2 points higher than 2.5 points higher than it was last week. I think Houston is a better team than Washington.
Yes. And is Washington a little bit of a national team where kind of the...
I don't know, maybe.
Anyway, all that said, percentage chances of victory...
Are you waiting on me to say something?
I'm waiting on you.
I would say about 75%.
I'm a little bit nervous about this one. I mean, I'm nervous about every game. I feel like it's a little bit less. I think it's like a 70% chance of victory. I can just see an avenue that Washington is able to. I mean, you look, Jameson Crowder had a good game last week, that they're able to feed Crowder.
Yeah, he might not play. Like, again, like 2 weeks ago, you would have asked me about this game. I would have said, I'm pretty scared about it.
Yes.
But now with the injuries, and we'll see whether some of these guys make it back, but I am not nearly as scared. I'm substantially less scared.
There's still a team that has a lot of talent, and I'm very scared of Chris Thompson. I'm scared of Crowder if he plays. Terrell Pryor still can stretch the field. It's an exciting player. I just don't...
But if anyone knows about Terrell Pryor's ability as a wide receiver, it is the Seattle Seahawks.
Yeah. I think it's about 70%, though.
Okay.
I'm nervous for it. And also, I think there's just kind of the coming off a high and feeling a little bit too confident.
That is certainly possible. Probably true among the fan base.
So, but hopefully we'll have this opportunity with a home game to get to 6-2. It would be pretty amazing.
That would be a really good first half of the season, and especially assuming that Earl Thomas's injury is as minor as it has been made out to be, you'd feel pretty good about where the Seahawks are at the midway point.
All right.
But we can talk about that next week. Until then.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.